Given deliberations about the future of Iraq and nation-building in the Middle East, there have been a number of references to Lawrence of Arabia in the press. Wolfowitz of Arabia was a recent New York Times column about Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz. President Bush was depicted on one magazine cover recently wearing Lawrence's Arab headdress. Thomas Edward Lawrence was the dashing, romanticized British officer credited with leading the Arab revolt against the Turks during the First World War. He's been compared to Homer and Napoleon, and dozens of biographies have been written about him. T.E. Lawrence left behind a legacy that has been debated vociferously by historians, who've questioned everything from his sexuality to whether he ever really reached Damascus at all. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports on the man and, as they say, the mirage.
There he is, riding camelback in his billowing white abaya, the Arab robes which flutter so beautifully in the desert winds, handsome, fair, enigmatically sexual, leading the charge of the Camel Corps from Arabia overland to a surprise attack on the Red Sea port of Aqaba.
There are guns at Aqaba.
They face the sea, Sheriff Ali, and cannot be turned round. From the landward side, there are no guns at Aqaba.
This is the cinematic Lawrence whom Peter O'Toole depicted in the David Lean Oscar-winning movie of 1962.
The desert is an ocean in which no oar is dipped. And on this ocean the Bedou go where they please and strike where they please. This is the way the Bedou has always fought. You're famed throughout the world for fighting in this way, and this is the way you should fight now.
But did Thomas Edward Lawrence look like that? Did he really wear those gorgeous desert robes? There are historians who say he never put on a headdress until he sat for a photo op at the end of World War I. But Jeremy Wilson, a past president of the T.E. Lawrence Society in England and Lawrence's official biographer, says the traditional dress was required.
He was asked at a very early stage to wear Arab clothes. This wasn't something that he did from choice, although he was quite pleased because they were much more comfortable for camel riding and the desert life generally than khaki. Bear in mind that this was close to Mecca and Medina, which are very sensitive areas for Islam. It was therefore very necessary that he should be as inconspicuous as possible in terms of being a Christian officer with a Muslim force.
It's Cairo, 1919. T.E. Lawrence hunches over a lantern in an Ottoman-style house, penning his historic recreation, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, a triumph. This is Lawrence's recounting of his 1916-18 Arab campaign. Turkey had allied itself with Germany, and Britain needed a proxy force to defend its flank, a precursor to the Coalition of the Willing. Lawrence's book begins, "Some of the evil of my tale may have been inherent in our circumstances. By day, the hot sun fermented us. At night, we were stained by dew and shamed into pettiness by the innumerable silences of stars." Seven Pillars has exquisite Victorian phrasing. Derring do, raids and counter-raids, men astride horseback and camel. Everything, says noted historian David Fromkin, except facts.
Reading Seven Pillars, you always have to bear in mind that he himself described it as a novel.
Hold on just a moment, says biographer Jeremy Wilson.
Seven Pillars of Wisdom is extremely accurate historically, and anybody who says it's a novel needs to do their homework.
We do know that in an age of British foreign intrigue, Britain wanted to dominate the Middle East. Lawrence wanted his epic to rank with Melville's Moby Dick and Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. And David Fromkin says Seven Pillars does just that.
It has an air of romance and strangeness. And besides, I find Lawrence a curiously attractive character. So all that is on the plus side. On the minus side, he never could make up his mind what story he wanted to tell, and that means that he contradicted himself several ways. It also means that you never know what the plot is, because there are three or four and they're quite different.
Perhaps because of the book's creation and recreations. Lawrence lost the first draft on a train in London. He rewrote it hurriedly in 1921. When Seven Pillars came out in 1926, it was for just a couple hundred special subscribers and a few dozen friends, costing more to publish than to buy. Then Lawrence himself vanished into the Royal Air Force under an assumed name. He was killed at 46 in a motorcycle accident in 1935 in Dorset. Within weeks of Lawrence's death, tens of thousands of copies of Seven Pillars of Wisdom were on the market. Within a decade, it had been translated into 16 languages. Jeremy Wilson says Lawrence called the book true in essence, perhaps wrong on a few details.
What it isn't is complete. There are ways in which, in a sense, Seven Pillars of Wisdom was a political tract, because while he does mention the contributions made by British and French and the Air Force and so on, nevertheless, in the overwhelming impression that you get from the book is that this was a campaign that was run by Arabs pretty well on their own efforts, whereas in fact the help that was provided by European contingents and the Air Force and so on was on many occasions really crucial.
Both writers agree that Lawrence wasn't original, the gifted, illegitimate son of an illegitimate son and baronet who took the name Lawrence. Thomas Edward Lawrence made his way to Jesus College, Oxford.
He was certainly an odd person, and everybody saw that. He made friends amongst people who had intellectual interests, but not others.
For Lawrence, a university passion for Arabic and the Crusader castles of Syria led soon enough to British intelligence during World War I and a map-making room in Cairo in 1914. Jeremy Wilson.
He wasn't a military man. He wasn't a politician. He had been, for the previous years, an archaeologist working in northern Syria on what is now the border with Turkey. He was an intellectual, if you like, and war turned him into a man of action, as sometimes happens.
But how did the man come to be in the Arabian Peninsula at all? Lawrence accompanied the British Oriental Secretary, Sir Ronald Storrs, to bolster the failing Arab revolt against the Turks. The Bedouin tribes were also fighting each other, and Britain wanted to unite them. Britain had already allied with Emir Hussein ibn Ali of Mecca and his sons Faisal and Abdullah. Lawrence makes Faisal one of the stars of Seven Pillars, and it was Faisal's military strategy, writes David Fromkin, to surprise the important port of Aqaba in Jordan by land. Afterward, Fromkin concedes, Lawrence did alone cross the formidable, enemy-held Sinai Desert to Cairo to deliver news of the conquest.
There is no doubt that he, essentially by himself, when Aqaba was liberated, crossed from Aqaba to Egypt to report that. That's an amazing feat. But it was typical of Lawrence to play down and be modest about the things he actually did while telling whoppers lies of all sorts about things he claims he had done.
And then there is Seven Pillars' homoerotic language and Lawrence's mysterious sexuality, culminating in the incident at Dera. Lawrence himself would call his kidnap and sodomization by the Turkish bey or commander of the Syrian border town of Dera the most soul-destroying episode of his life. David Fromkin says he's deeply suspicious it occurred. Wilson is confident it happened. It's cryptic, but surely, says Wilson, a reference to male rape.
I think so, because it is consistent with Lawrence's subsequent life. If you look at the studies of people who have suffered from male rape, they exhibit similar patterns of behavior to Lawrence in important ways. After the war, sex was a complete switch-off for him. He didn't like being physically touched at all, but, I mean, he avoided all sexual approaches, both from women and from men, and he had both. He was completely sexless insofar as other people were concerned. He was left with, however, a flagellation disorder, which was a pretty rare occurrence. He arranged to have himself beaten in what appears to be some kind of reconstruction of the Dera incident.
Lawrence did not change the map of the Middle East. The spheres of influence had been drawn up secretly between Britain and France in 1916. But both Fromkin and Wilson agree on this, that Lawrence, almost alone among British officers at the time, wanted independence and self-rule for the Arabs. Writer Jeremy Wilson.
The great majority of the Arab tribesmen with whom he was dealing, these were people who were, by today's standards, not educated. They weren't stupid, and Lawrence had a regard for those people, which I think was very real. And his views about what should happen was that the Arabs should be given their self-government. And he said, you know, doubtless they will make some mistakes, but everybody makes mistakes. But it's for them to work out their future, and it shouldn't be imposed upon them by the great powers.
Lawrence says Fromkin was a 20th century exemplar. His title, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, comes from Proverbs. Wisdom hath builded a house. She hath hewn it out of her seven pillars. Perhaps as Lawrence fashioned his tale. Later this fall, Castle Hill Press in England will introduce two new hardcover editions of Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Jackie Lydon, NPR News.